for spiritual rest from war within. This is Biblical Answers with Reverend Ted Pike from truthtellers.org.
This reading is entitled The Story of the Khazars. It's from an appendix in my book, Israel, Our Duty, Our Dilemma. The greatest source of pride for Jews is their belief that they are the blood descendants of Abraham. Out of that conviction has come not only identity, but deep comfort through the ages. Modern scholarship, however, has begun to question whether all who consider themselves Jews are in fact Jews at all. There is mounting evidence that the great majority of Jews today, that is, the Ashkenazim or Eastern European Jews, are not the offspring of Abraham, but descendants of the ancient Central European nation of Khazaria, converted to Judaism in 740 AD. Khazaria's conversion to Judaism is unquestioned. What remains in doubt is what became of the roughly million Khazarians in the centuries following conversion. Did they dissolve into the nations of Central Europe? Or did they remain relatively intact, migrating to such countries as Poland, Lithuania, and Russia, laying the foundation for the massive so-called Jewish populations of Eastern Europe, the source of most Jews living in Russia and the United States today? To begin to unravel this question, we will turn to the articles on Khazars in the Encyclopedia Judaica, the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, the Jewish Encyclopedia, and the Encyclopedia Britannica. The 13th Tribe is the exhaustively researched study of the Khazars by the eminent modern Jewish writer Arthur Koestler. It will provide us not only with vital background information, but conclusion about the final destiny of the Khazars, which the encyclopedias omit. Who were the Khazars? Where had they come from? Koestler says, "The country of the Khazars, a people of Turkish stock, occupied a strategic key position at the vital gateway between the Black Sea and the Caspian, where the great eastern powers of the period confronted each other. It acted as a buffer protecting Byzantium against invasions by the lusty barbarian tribesmen of the northern steppes, Bulgars, Magyars, Pechenegs, etc., and later the Vikings and Russians. But equally, of even more importance both from the point of view of Byzantine diplomacy and of European history, is the fact that the Khazar armies effectively blocked the Arab avalanche in its most devastating early stages, and thus prevented the Muslim conquest of Eastern Europe. The Khazars, according to the Encyclopedia Judaica, may have been the descendants of Attila the Hun. Like other Turkish peoples, they manifested the strongest warlike traits, yet were often gifted with commercial and artistic genius. At the peak of their prosperity and power, they exacted tribute from no fewer than 30 nations of Central Europe over whom they held undisputed dominion. However, during the 8th century, Khazaria found itself embarrassed. The other nations surrounding it were adopting the more advanced monotheistic religions of Byzantine Christianity or Islam, while Khazaria languished in the primitive superstitions of a nation of nomads and warriors. It was time for a new religion. In 740 AD, the Khagan, or king, summoned representatives of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism to his presence, each being provided with the opportunity to state its case. In the end, Judaism was accepted as Khazaria's new religion, probably because it carried no obligation for military alliances, as did Byzantine Christianity and Islam. For over 400 years, well into the 13th century, Judaism thrived as the state religion of the people of Khazaria. The Khazars, whose most educated guess as to who might be their founding father would have been Attila the Hun, came to believe they were descendants, not of the Golden Horde, but of Abraham. The Khazars studied Hebrew, venerated the Talmud and Torah, yearned for the coming of Messiah, and actually hoped to soon retake Jerusalem from the Muslims and return to the land of their forefathers. By the 9th century, however, the Vikings were already sending their fleets down the Volga and Don, threatening Khazaria. In the years to come, the Khazars bitterly resented intrusions of the Northmen, protecting not only themselves from conquest, but Byzantium to the southwest. Yet the Norsemen, or Rus, forefathers of modern Russians, gradually gained the upper hand while Khazaria declined. The Rus made an alliance with Khazaria's traditional ally, Byzantium, and together in 1016 AD, they treacherously invaded and conquered Khazaria, bringing to an end the autonomy of one of the most powerful and strategic nations of the ancient world. In the following century, the fabric of Khazarian life was further rent by invasions of the Cumans, a wild barbaric horde from the steppes of Asia. Yet far worse was the full-scale invasion in 1245 of the terrible Mongol hordes led by Genghis Khan. Before the terror of Genghis Khan, not only the Khazars, but most inhabitants of Central Europe fled to the west. Yet the Khazars, traditionally a nation of nomads, had been migrating west and northwest for centuries, even before the earlier invasions of the Rus. By the time of the Mongols, Khazar communities were well established in Hungary and the Ukraine, in the Balkans, southern Russia, in Slavic lands, in Lithuania, but most of all, Poland. With the first awakenings of civilization in Poland, beginning with the founding of the first Piast dynasty in 962 AD, the Khazars, because of their commercial background as artisans, middlemen, and traders, were especially welcome as settlers. It was not long before one Polish city contained five synagogues, while many towns had at least two. In fact, complaints began to come before the magistrates that Khazar synagogues, because of their height and opulence, were putting Christian edifices to shame. Legislation was demanded to limit them in size and number. Yet, even as late as the 15th and 16th centuries, Khazars continued to arrive and prosper in Poland, making Poland the new Khazaria to roughly half a million displaced Khazars. It was well into the 17th century before the racial isolation of the Khazar communities in Poland, Lithuania, and Russia was significantly altered by contact with authentic descendants of Abraham from the West. During the Muslim conquests and after the Jewish exodus from Babylon in the 11th century, most true Jews had settled in the lands surrounding the Mediterranean, especially Spain. Only relatively small numbers of such Jews inhabited northern Europe. Despite claims by Jewish historians that mass migrations of authentic Jews moved east into Khazar territories as a result of such calamities as the Crusades, the Black Death, and the Inquisition, Kostler thoroughly documents the absence of any historic basis for such alleged movements. Concerning genuine Jewish populations in the German Rhineland before and after the First Crusade, Kostler says, "The traditional conception of Jewish historians that the Crusades of 1096 swept like a broom a mass migration of German Jews into Poland is simply a legend, or rather an ad hoc hypothesis invented because, as they knew little of Khazar history, they could see no other way to account for the emergence, out of nowhere, of this unprecedented concentration of Jews in Eastern Europe. Yet there is not a single mention in the contemporary sources of any migration, large or small, from the Rhineland further east into Germany, not to mention distant Poland. History records that from the Dark Ages through the Renaissance, authentic Jewry in Northern Europe constituted a pitifully small population. Such Jews did not respond to persecution, as Koster points out, by migration, but by seeking what local protection they could find, only to return to their ransacked houses and synagogues. Such a situation is formidably opposed to Jewish prosperity in the lands of Northern Europe. In fact, German Jewry in the late Middle Ages hovered on the edge of extinction. Imagine, then, the plight of the Jews when in 1348, the year of the Black Death, the suspicion erupted within the crazed inhabitants of Europe that Jews had begun the plague by poisoning Gentile wells. The effect of the resulting persecution was to nearly decimate the Jewish population in Germany. Yet such persecution did not move them eastward. There is no record of any of them escaping to Poland, as Jewish scholarship would have us believe. Nor is there record that in the centuries to come such an enfeebled German Jewish population would lay the foundation for the massive so-called Jewish Ashkenazi populations in Poland. After suffering a plague brought on by rats and renewed persecution by men, the Austrian historian Kuchera describes the condition Jews of Western Germany now found themselves in. He says, "The populace avenged on them the cruel blows of destiny, and set upon those whom the plague had spared with fire and sword. When the epidemics receded, Germany, according to contemporary historians, was left virtually without Jews." We are led to conclude that in Germany itself, the Jews did not prosper and were never able to establish large and populous communities. How then, in this circumstance, should they have been able to lay the foundation in Poland of a mass population so dense that at present, and he writes in AD 1909, it outnumbers the Jews of Germany at the rate of 10 to 1. It is indeed difficult to understand how the idea ever gained ground that the Eastern Jews represent immigrants from the West, and especially from Germany. Kossler also comments on the supposed role of the Black Death in establishing Eastern Germany. He says, "Yet, next to the First Crusade, the Black Death is most frequently invoked by historians as the deus ex machina which created Eastern Jewry. And, just as in the case of the Crusades, there is not a shred of evidence for this imaginary exodus. Ultimately, the first widespread contact between Khazars and Jews of the West occurred as a result of the anti-Semitic Chmielnicki massacres in Poland of 1648 and 49. A wave of Khazar immigration began out of Poland to the West, a migration which continued almost three centuries until World War II. It is out of that migration, beginning midpoint in the 17th century, that the principal Jewish settlements of Europe, the United States, and Israel have been formed." Curiously, a study of Yiddish, the language of the Polish Khazars, also confirms the absence of authentic Jewry in Poland before the mid-17th century. Yiddish, of course, began as the Jewish lingua franca, language of commerce. It combined Hebrew with the East Middle German spoken by the German bourgeoisie class, which dominated Polish culture during the period in which Yiddish was formed. Kossler points out that if authentic Jews had been in Poland in the time of Yiddish's evolution during and after the 15th century, then words of the West German dialect spoken by Jews of the West would also be found in Yiddish. Yet, according to Kossler, Yiddish is untainted by West German influence. In contrast to thousands of Hebrew, East German, and Slavonic words in Yiddish, there is not a West German word to be found, proving that authentic Jews had no part in the cultural life which produced Yiddish. If Jews from the West had been unable to influence Yiddish, which in the period of its formation was a linguistic free-for-all, inviting the contributions of anyone, is it credible that they would have made any significant contribution to the gene pool of the Polish Khazars? Hardly. It cannot be denied that from the day Khazaria was converted to Judaism, Jews worldwide had been vaguely aware of a Jewish state to the east, and some may even have visited and intermarried. Yet such infinitesimal commingling of genuine Jewish blood in the veins of hundreds of thousands of Khazars would not have compared to the much more frequent inbreeding which must have inevitably occurred between the Khazars and the Hungarians, Russian, and Poles who surrounded them. We have the strongest evidence, then, from historic and linguistic sources that the Ashkenazi Khazarian population of Eastern Europe, which is the source of most so-called Jews today, if not 100% Gentile before the mid-17th century, was very near it. With this in mind, the Jewish claim that all Jews of Eastern Europe contain at least some of the blood of Abraham becomes spurious, the crudest attempt to preserve the Ashkenazim from being as Gentile as the verdict of history declares them to be. Rejecting history, Khazar Jewish scholarship scrabbles for even the smallest claim to the patrimony of Abraham. Such is essential not only to the self-esteem of Eastern European so-called Jewry, but to legitimize the present Jewish claim to Palestine, a claim which has been most insistently made by those of Khazar origin. But as Kossler documents so formidably, the most any Eastern European Jew can claim with confidence is that his forefathers were converted to Judaism out of paganism. As Kossler, himself most likely a German Jew of Khazar origin, laconically concludes. He says the story of the Khazar Empire, as it slowly emerges from the past, begins to look like the most cruel hoax which history has ever perpetuated. I didn't include this reading when I set out this article because I didn't think it was, strictly speaking, a Bible study. But the truth of the matter is that even though we did not crack open a Bible study in this time tonight, it is an issue which impacts, reflects very powerfully upon Christian eschatology. Because the very dearest idea for a Jew is the idea that he is a descendant of Abraham, so also Christians are imbued with the necessity that Jews have descended from Abraham, especially considering the unconditional support which Christians have given for the very, very largely mass occupation of Palestine by Khazarian Ashkenazi Jews. And believe me, this thesis continues to make most Jews extremely nervous, especially passionately pro-Zionist Jews, because if the 5 or 6 million Jews who have come into Palestine are not really the descendants of Abraham, but are the descendants from Attila the Hun, then what right did they have to come in, especially in the months before Jewish independence in 1948, and violently expel 800,000 Palestinian farmers and merchants and people, including Palestinian Christians, violently tear them out of their ancestral homes and orchards and farms and businesses and herd them off into concentration camps such as Gaza and other concentration camps, UN concentration camps, where many of them still remain today. This is a thorny and a very, very sensitive issue. The attitude of most Ashkenazi is basically, let science be damned, let history be damned. We're going to claim that we are the children of Abraham. They are very, very resistant to the idea to think that they are basically Asiatics from the steppes of Asia, with roots going back to Turks, Huns, and so on, from antiquity. Interestingly enough, also, there is a divide within the anti-Zionist ranks. Some, such as David Duke and Dr. Kevin MacDonald, are very, very adamant in support of the Rhineland theory that the huge Ashkenazi population, eventually reaching 9, 10 million, 11 million in Eastern Europe, was a result of exponentially great population growth starting around the 15th or 16th century. And the reason they insist on that is because they are very interested in basically believing that Jews are pure because it provides a genetic test bed in which Jewish chromosomes became so degenerate in the 500 years since the Jews out of the Rhineland went into Eastern Europe, that all the good Jews, all Jews with any sensitivity and morality and tenderness and humanity, were driven out of Judaism. And what happened was, in the shtetls and in the enclosed, very ingrown Jewish communities of Eastern Europe, especially Poland, all the bad genes, all the hateful, violent, bad, and bigoted genes were allowed to remain and interbreed, producing basically a race of killer bees, human killer bees devoid of humanity, devoid even of souls, as David Duke told me in a telephone conversation. He told me that God does not hear the prayer of a Jewish child because natural selection, the evolutionary process, has worked inexorably for some 500 years to produce a species of robotic, almost destroyers of civilization, who become liberals, who become communists, who work to subvert and tear down civilization because of their genes, because of the natural selection process of weeding out good people for 500 years in Eastern Europe and keeping only the very worst elements. And so according to this point of view, this racist point of view, Jews are soulless destroyers of civilization today because they were relatively pure Jews who became isolated in Eastern Europe for at least 500 years, allowed to create a Jewish genome which is corrupting and perverse. Now, the present Jewish researcher, John Hopkins geneticist, Dr. Elhaik, he says the evidence is overwhelming that the genome of Eastern European Jewry goes right back to the Caucasus, goes back to Central Eurasia. And so these people in the racist, anti-Zionist right are being deprived by Elhaik and deprived by the genetic researches he is doing of their claim that they have a perfect test bed to demonstrate Jewish degeneracy in the genetic development of Jews in Eastern Europe. So they are very much against Kostler. They are very much against what Elhike is doing and what he is irrefutably demonstrating to the world, which is that the great majority of Eastern European Jews are Khazars. Now, he is not excluding the fact of Middle Eastern genes which are present in the genome of Eastern European Jews. He is saying that they are not so abundant or specific that we can definitively trace them back to Palestine or make Jews into the seed of Abraham. And I'm not going to go into this into much more detail, but I do have in a recent article entitled, "Are the Jews Really Khazars?" I go into the spiritual meaning, spiritual significance of why God allowed these Asiatics from the East to come in and to engraft themselves in with Judaism, actually take over Judaism and so on, how this is a fulfillment of God's curse in the Old Testament on the authentic Jews, that if they did not obey God, he would allow aliens to come in, and these aliens would insert themselves into the Jewish people and oppress the Jewish people. I make the point that this is a profound and a very neglected fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And God cursed the Jewish people, the authentic Jews who rebelled against him, become a very, very small people. And that's why authentic Jews today constitute not more than 3 million out of the entire population of so-called Jews. That's why they are small, they are cursed, but God has allowed the Khazars to come in to undergird them and propel them, the very talented, gifted Khazars to come in and to make Judaism and make Kabbalah and make all of the racism and world revolution that's inherited in the Talmud and Kabbalah their own cause. And out of Poland, out of Eastern Europe, flooded the world with the revolutionaries and the Bolsheviks and the communists and the liberals who are presently moving the world toward a one-world government. And so in God's plan, he allowed the Khazars to come in order to facilitate all of the evil ambitions that would have been otherwise impossible for the relatively small number of authentic Jews in the world today. I should probably say that I have written articles pointing out the fallacies in Duke and MacDonald's position, that I do not agree with any hypothesis that says that the Jewish people are genetically degenerate. The Jews have indeed, in a general way, given themselves to liberalism, to the liberal socialist cause. They have gravitated in a general way for their most gifted members to dominance over the media, dominance even in Congress, and they circle around Obama and the White House, and it goes without saying that they control the Federal Reserve Bank and Wall Street and so on. But this is not a result of genetic degeneracy. The problem with the Jews and with Israel from the time, well, even before their rejection and crucifixion of Jesus, is that they made wrong decisions. They made wrong moral choices. And the compounding and extending of these wrong moral decisions to this very moment is the reason that they have gone into spiritual darkness and set themselves against Christianity, even against capitalism, and are working toward ascendancy in a new world order. And so basically the big problem with the Jews is not a genetic one. The big problem with the Jews is that 2,000 years ago they turned their back on Jesus Christ, their true Messiah, and said, let's follow the Pharisees who killed Jesus instead. And at that juncture in their road, in their destiny, they went deeper and deeper into darkness and apostasy and are enveloped in that today. For this reason, the individual Jew, regardless of his political background or national, racial origins and so on, he can turn to Jesus Christ through an act of his free will. Jesus is there saying, "Come unto me, you're heavy laden with the Talmud, and you're heavy laden with racistic bigotry, and you're heavy laden with hatred against Christians. Humble yourself and come to me, and for I am meek and lowly in heart, and I have come as the true Messiah to gather Israel." And the fact of the matter is that someday, Scripture says, when Jesus comes and when a remnant out of Israel will be saved, that remnant will include probably a minority of authentic descendants of the tribe of Judah. But as Ezekiel 47 makes very clear, it says that their proselytes, the proselytes of the authentic minority of Jews, which must mean the Khazars, will also be allowed as converts to enter in to service as priests in the millennial kingdom for 1,000 years, praising Jesus as the true Messiah. And so this is the light, of course, of this very, very dark tunnel of darkness and liberalism and confusion, as well as generation of tremendous strife over the last century in the Middle East. The light at the end of the tunnel is that the grace of Jesus Christ, the mercy of Jesus, is there at the end of the age to call the Jews back to himself and call them out of great tribulation and persecution back to his holy land. And that's why true Christianity, very much differently from these racist ideas which I've been talking about, true Christianity does not view the Jews as this misshapen, toxic person who is genetically and morally poisonous because of environmental and hereditary circumstances. The true Christian views him as being tragically misled by the ancient Pharisees for 2,000 years and caught up and chained and imprisoned in a very dark, very, very dark apostate system. But Jesus has promised to us, especially in the Old Testament scriptures which he inspired, that he will have mercy upon a Jewish remnant. Romans 9 says, "The Redeemer shall come from Zion and shall turn ungodliness from Jacob." That's a wonderful promise written by Paul after Jesus had gone to heaven. He's talking about a separate dispensation than Jesus brought in through his death at Calvary. He's talking about something in the future when the Redeemer Jesus Christ will come again out of Zion. And the true Zion he's talking about there is the heavenly Zion. Earthly Zion is but an archetype, a pattern of the heavenly Zion. Jesus comes out of Zion and he redeems a believing remnant. "And they shall look upon him whom their fathers pierced," and it says they shall mourn, and they'll come and we will beg for forgiveness from Jesus, their true Messiah. So this whole tragic story, this whole epic story of the apostate Jews being cursed to be small, but the Khazars coming in to assist them toward world dominion, but the whole thing collapsing as the Antichrist turns upon both true and converted Khazar Jews, leading them into great tribulation, but Jesus coming just at the nick of time, at the end of the age, as the Gentiles are about to slaughter every last Jew they possibly can, Jesus comes to that beleaguered remnant, and they look upon him. They realize for the first time in at least 2,000 years the magnitude of their sin and failure and darkness in rejecting the one who actually called them to be his spiritual bride thousands of years earlier. So it all has a happy ending, but only because of what Jesus will do. And this is a reminder, of course, to all of humanity that regardless of how dark and twisted and seemingly insoluble our problems are, marital problems, family problems, health problems, all these problems, Jesus is the deliverer. Jesus specializes in turning the impossible into the possible as he turns darkness into light and turns evil into good according to his miraculous powers. And this is a reminder that if we are in what seem to be hopeless circumstances, let's do what the Jews will do someday. Let's turn our eyes upward to Jesus, our true Messiah and Redeemer. And he will come down, he will reciprocate, and he will make a way where there seems to be no way.
For more thought-provoking Bible studies and articles, visit truthtellers.org. If you would like to support the National Prayer Network as your church, any contributions are gratefully received. Donate online at truthtellers.org/store or send your tithe to the National Prayer Network, P.O. Box 828, Clackamas, Oregon 97015. All donations are tax deductible. This has been a production of the National Prayer Network.